just as you wouldn't take necessarily financial advice from your dentist or take car mechanic advice from your doctor, you probably shouldn't take much advice from your jiu-jitsu instructor other than jiu-jitsu advice.
Today is a BJJ black belt, martial artist, and firefighter with an academic background in biology who has also recently just completed a 1,000-mile solo canoe trip through Canada's Arctic. And today, we discuss the strange but undoubtedly important intersection between science and martial arts. Things like the ability to logically and cognitively break down ideas or techniques, or even how to have a little skepticism when it comes to things like martial arts instructors asking to be called professor or sifu. Not only that, we chat about being the best in a field versus being highly skilled in many areas, and how this ties into ideas like diminishing returns, experiencing the richness of existence, and where the balance in life is between being disciplined, focused, and achieving a goal, and when you should actually just quit and change tracks. And lastly, of course, we talk about my guest's epic 1,000-mile solo canoe journey through the Arctic. My guest lays out some of the preparation, some of the unexpected emotions, and a few of the experiences along the way. And as a last point, because a lot of us are sick of hearing about coronavirus, I would like to mention that we discussed the coronavirus situation specifically within the martial arts community and the associated politics for about the first 15 minutes of this episode. So if that is not of interest to you, please feel free to skip ahead by about 15 minutes to the next topic of conversation. So, with all this in mind, please welcome my guest, the polymath, Stefan Kesting.
Mind-bending chemicals.
I don't care, he wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
In my other life, as a firefighter, I'm a hazmat specialist, and really, I mean, I don't use my science background that often, except for the fact that it doesn't make... I'm not intimidated by big words, because... Yeah. 1, 2, 3 trimethyl octane is no better or worse than benzene just because it's got a longer name. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably benzene's worse for you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And there probably is no 1, 3, 8 trimethyl octane. That would be a no name, but whatever.
Probably is somewhere. Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned pontificating there. So you are actually taking sort of quite a strong stance for the reason that you do have a scientific background kind of thing within coronavirus and within jiu-jitsu specifically then.
Oh, we're going straight for the jugular here.
Why and, not?
The most possibly controversial position I could be taking.
Really?
Although it may not be as controversial with the international audience. Okay. I've generally found the most violent reactions and the death threats, quite honestly, are coming more from the American audience.
Really? Death threats?
Where science is... totally polarized right now.
Right.
Like it's really a very, very political statement to comment on the state of a clinical trial on hydroxychloroquine. Like that is actually a political statement. It works. It doesn't work. I mean, it shouldn't be. Like it really, really shouldn't. I mean, either the damn stuff works or doesn't, or it's indeterminate and we need more studies. And I mean, that's what a study might show. But by saying it works, you get accused of being a Trump supporter. And by saying it doesn't work, you get accused of being a leftist libtard, communist person who wants to have the lizards control the earth from Pedo Island. Like it's crazy how politicized it is. And I think I was one of the first people in the jiu-jitsu community to raise the alarm and say, we shouldn't train right now. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to do our part in social isolation and social distancing here. And there really is no better way to transmit this virus than maybe group sex. And I don't know that much about group sex, but I do know a lot about jiu-jitsu. And really, me rolling on the ground with a whole bunch of people, one after another, and basically breathing as hard as we possibly can. And then switching partners and
sweat and
I mean, jiu-jitsu, the sport where putting your balls in another man's face is normal, right? it's a very close proximity thing. In fact, A friend of mine who's been training in the traditional Japanese martial arts for a long time just sent me a couple of articles. One is about a kendo dojo in Japan.
Okay.
So in kendo, I mean, it's not even grappling. It's we're standing back and hitting each other with sticks, and maybe we'll get within a couple feet of each other. But they're doing a lot of yelling. Wah! As they hit with the bamboo swords. And really, that's a pretty good way to spread this virus, it appears, right? I mean, you take a look, and this is anecdotal. You take a look at the cases of transmission in churches or among choirs, right, where they're projecting a lot, and inevitably they're spraying droplets all over the place. If you go outside on a cold day, and you breathe out, there's a big puff of fog, essentially, or condensation. That's your breath, right? If you want to see how far that travels, go outside on a cold day and go, or sing, or go do a kendo yell.
Yeah.
And you're going to get a cloud of white particulate moving through the air. And there's also some cases where some judo clubs in Japan, basically everyone has been quarantined in it. And I think, what is a kendo club? 100 people, all of whom are quarantined, 18 of whom have coronavirus. So that's pretty effective transmission.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it here with some of the guys I train with, that it literally is just... It's the perfect thing to be doing for spreading a virus. And the city, I'm in Korea, and the city that I'm in was sort of the first city outside of China to really get quite serious quite quickly.
Well, good.
Our measures...
The problem is it's a little bit a victim of his own success, right? I live in...
For sure.
...in British Columbia, in Canada, and we, through a bunch of intentional and unintentional circumstances... The curve got flattened pretty quick relative to the States and relative to the rest of Canada. I mean, some of it was foresight on the part of the provincial health authorities, and some of it on the part of the provincial government. And some of it was just plain luck in the sense that spring break ended 2 weeks later, ended 2 weeks earlier here than it did in other parts of Canada, meaning that people were coming back from Florida or
going
wherever.
Home. Yep.
Yeah. Earlier. And then there was also pretty good compliance with social distancing. And the curve really has been flattened. But now you're beginning to see, like, well, and it's not as much here as in the United States, but you see a bit of it, like, dude, what's the problem? I only know one person who has this, and they're old, and they survived or they didn't or whatever. But if we hadn't isolated, it'd be all over the place. Everybody would know 10 people. I mean, if you take a look at Iran, or you take a look at Italy, or you take a look even at China. I don't believe much of the data coming out of China, but I do believe this. I believe that the Chinese hold their economy pretty sacred, and they are willing to do anything they can to boost their economy. I mean, look what their record is on human rights. Look at what their record is on their environment. They're willing to destroy all of that to keep their economy humming. And to shut down their economy...
It's a big deal. Yeah.
And they may not share the true data with the rest of the world, but I bet they had good data for themselves. And they must have at some point looked at and gone, holy shit, if we don't do this now, we're screwed.
Yeah.
So that I think is one of the truest signals that we can get out of China. Like, they saw the data and they took it super seriously, reasonably early, and lied to the rest of the world. I know there's people yelling, like, China lied. Yeah, I bet it did. And so, you know, in certain parts of Canada and certainly parts of the US, you know, that have managed to flatten the curve, well, it's a victim of its own success. I was looking at the, some of the statistics from the Spanish flu roughly 100 years ago, and there were cities that relaxed their initial quarantine measures early and immediately got a second spike.
Yeah.
So it raises a very interesting question. Even if you think that the world economy is going to be totally destroyed by this, and it's totally possible that it will it be more or less destroyed by opening up early and allowing that second spike? And I don't know, but I think it's a significant hazard. And now I'm outside area of expertise. I'm not an economist.
And that's the point everyone is sort of talking about, right? It's like, when is the correct time? And, you know, I suppose I don't really want to bang on about coronavirus too much because, like, probably... a lot of people, you get a bit sick of hearing it. You're kind of so oversaturated. But, you know, it is sort of important mentioning what you're talking about there is the sort of polarization, p- politically that has come about, especially in the US that you were sort of mentioning? Again, without going on about it too much, but why do you think that is? Why is that arising sort of so painfully in the US, like you said specifically, and why is that coming out so much in jiu-jitsu as well? It seems to be that it's sort of cut down the middle within jiu-jitsu too.
Yeah. I mean, I, for a long time, long before coronavirus, I've contended that, you know, just as you wouldn't take necessarily financial advice from your dentist or take car mechanic advice from your doctor, you probably shouldn't take much advice from your jiu-jitsu instructor other than jiu-jitsu advice.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the worst health and fitness and wellness advice I've ever received has been from well-meaning but totally misinformed jiu-jitsu people, including and martial arts people, including some pretty highly ranked names. And no, I'm not going to mention any of them.
Please don't.
So I think this reflexive is one of the reasons why I personally dislike the term professor. I personally dislike the term sifu, sensei, senpai, sijo, all of these honorifics. I don't like them. I like Stefan for myself. And I think that creates an atmosphere of reflexive bowing to authority. Like, if it's just different if you treat... I mean, I've heard, and I haven't tested it, but if you check into a hotel and you put doctor, you know, Dr. Stefan Kesting versus Stefan Kesting, that you immediately get treated better by the hotel staff. And I could see why. We have this slightly reflexive bowing to authority, and professor is the same way. But really, our jiu-jitsu instructors are presumably good at jiu-jitsu. And maybe they're good at healing injuries because they've had a lot of injuries.
They've been through it, yeah.
Yeah, to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I'm... I am a skeptic by nature, I suppose. And it's also very, very easy to believe. You know, I think that one should distrust things that one wants to believe.
Mm-hmm.
If you hear something that you go, yes, I totally want to believe that, maybe you should question it. Maybe it's too good to be true. You know, if you're some hot, if you're some middling hot chick and some guy's going like, you're so beautiful. You're the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. Maybe you should be suspicious, right?
Like, maybe it's a bit of bias there, should we say.
Yeah. You want to hear it. You're desperate to hear it, but there may be an agenda there is all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's pretty good advice. It's sort of in general, not only when we're talking about pandemics and other things like that. So the reaction of the jiu-jitsu sort of community has been relatively positive, would you say? Or
to my carrying on about the COVID thing?
Correct, yeah. Haven't heard, I just want to say, I haven't heard you sort of carry on about COVID, which it sounds like you've been in a couple of other podcasts and written a couple of articles about it, but I haven't seen.
I have released some of my own podcasts about it on the Strenuous Life podcast. I have written some articles about it.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them got picked up on Reddit quite strongly, so that's on my blog. I have been quite active about this on my Facebook, my personal Facebook. And a little bit on my Grapple Arts Facebook and on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's just such a blizzard of information. I'm not surprised that you've missed it.
So much.
Martial arts in this, and we're really talking mostly about the States. I mean, there are definitely conspiracy theorists and, you know, this whole thing is a hoax, people in the rest of the world. It's definitely true, but it's mostly in the States that it's a particularly virulent ground for that. So I mean, in the States, roughly half the people are Republican and roughly half the people are Democratic, very roughly. Trump's support right now is somewhere between 40% and 50%, but I'm sure somebody's going to be yelling at me for that. And because Trump said things like hydroxychloroquine look really promising, everybody then had to rally to that. And anybody who questioned that, it's not just questioning the drug, it's questioning their leader. Or the weird one is the people who are still calling it a hoax, right? I mean, for a while, Trump was calling it a hoax. Then he switched to calling it a pandemic. So what happened to all those followers who were like, yes, this is a hoax. This is a hoax. This, oh, wait a second. Our leader has changed. It's still a hoax and he's getting bad advice or something like that. That must be very confusing. And I don't blame people for being confused right now because there is a ton of conflicting information. And if you want a conspiracy theory, here's a conspiracy theory. I've got a conspiracy theory.
Okay.
There's pretty good evidence that most people would agree that Russia tried to meddle in the last elections.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to stir dissent in the United States, if you wanted to reduce the effectiveness of one of your prime adversaries, it'd be pretty easy and pretty low cost to stir hatred online around something as initially divisive as coronavirus. So who knows how many of these extreme views, people tweeting, you know, I fucking hope that all these leftist libtards get corona and die, versus I hope these frickin' redneck hicks go to church and get infected by their pastor, or like just the most virulent, ugly things that you can say. It is quite possible that some of this is coming from
more than
people
possible,
who want to stir the
I
pot.
Think. Yeah.
Like if I was in charge of Russia, I'd be willing to spend $10 million to watch it. Like, that'd be a very cheap return on investment. So
absolutely.
Everyone needs a conspiracy theory. That's my conspiracy theory. And there was an article in the New York Times about it. Is it true? I don't know, but it's certainly viable.
Yeah, it's definitely viable. I mean, in the past, like you said, with the elections, there was clear evidence of sort of meddling going on. And it's not like it was found out and then they immediately stopped doing it in an opportunity like this.
Whoops.
Sorry about that. Yeah, it's not quite as realistic. All right, so...
Well, when the President of the United States says he's talked with Putin and he's a good guy and he doesn't think this happened, despite the advice of his intelligence community, I would take... If I was... regardless of whether that's was well-intentioned or some kind of 4D chess, if I was Russia, I would go, awesome.
Sounds
now
good.
Now I can continue. Yeah.
Exactly. All right, so we don't kill too many of the listeners with more coronavirus information, let's talk a little bit about what you were saying before about the education you sort of had. Now, obviously, you sort of mentioned how, I guess, important having maybe like an academic understanding or a scientific understanding has done just for your sort of your general business and things. You know, you can read scientific papers. Maybe you're skeptical in a manner that other people might not be. But at the time, after you finished your studies or during your studies, did you sort of flirt with the idea of staying in academia and not sort of going the route that you've gone now, which is more of a sort of jiu-jitsu business existence?
Well, initially, I thought I was going to be an academic.
Mm-hmm.
That was my bachelor's. And when I did my bachelor's, I did very well. I got very high marks and I got a scholarship for my master's. And I got various scholarships for my undergraduate. And I found I hated it. I really, really, really didn't like it. I think that's one of the things I've had to come to terms with. It used to be that if you put me in front of a pile of shit, even if it was a pile of shit, I would try to climb to the top just reflexively. So there was the academic pile of shit, and I was like, must claw my way to the top here, without really thinking about whether it made me happy or not. So by the time I finished my undergraduate and worked in the field for a little bit as a research assistant, I was pretty burned out. And one of the dreams I had, I basically had wanted to do a long canoe trip up north in northern Canada. And I was working as a bicycle courier one day, and there were no calls or no jobs. So I went into the map library at the University of Toronto and just started looking at maps, because I like looking at maps. And it was a way to kill some time. And before I had finished, I connected a route. It was about, I want to say, roughly 1,000 kilometers.
Wow.
Heading up to, from northern Ontario up to Hudson Bay, and from Hudson Bay back to Lake Superior. If anyone really cares, it was the full length of the Missinaba River, then up the Albany River, then up the Kenogami River to Long Lac, and then down to Lake Superior. And so I did this kind of to celebrate graduating. And it gave me a lot of time to think, right? I spent a lot of time. I'd never been alone by myself for 4 weeks, I think, that trip took. it was truncated a little bit at the end by a death in the family. So that was a pretty wild thing, like coming off of this incredible high.
Definitely.
Like finally getting back to civilization, making a phone call, and finding out that my brother had died.
Right, a very rude awakening.
Motorcycle accident. Yeah, so that was a... I've already sworn. That was a mindfuck.
Yeah,
for sure.
Swear as much as you like, yeah. Yeah.
But it also gave me a bunch of time to think. Mm-hmm. And I remember like crashing my way on some non-existent portage through some incredibly dense spruce forest around a non-navigable rapid. And just it being really tough. Mm-hmm. And thinking like, do I want to take advantage of that scholarship that I have to do a master's? And I was like, I'm only going to do it if it gets me back up north, if it gets me back into the bush. And so having a pretty decent scholarship gave me the advantage of being able to pick and choose supervisors as opposed to having to go begging for supervisors. Yep. And I found somebody who thought that floating down another Arctic river in the Northwest Territories for a summer to do a survey related to climate change, seeing as I've alienated all the... most of the Trump supporters already by talking about...
Keep it going.
Hydroxychloroquine. I might as well talk about global warming, too.
Yep.
That I found a supervisor who thought it would be an all right idea for me to use my set of skills, which I had, to basically spend the summer out in the bush in the Arctic, floating across the tree line. And so that was a... That's why I went back and did a master's. I was pretty much done with academia. This is my last stab at it. And I didn't really... I mean, I enjoyed the summer. That was very interesting. And I mean, there's something about catching a caribou migration through the Northwest Territories that's amazing anytime.
And, wow.
You know, seeing grizzly bears in their natural environment. And that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But most of academia is sitting and writing your reports, writing up your research, and I really didn't enjoy that. And so I was twisting and turning and trying to figure out how to get out of that field. And that's hard. It's hard to change track when
definitely you've
been focused on one thing. Focus. So that's how I finally... And then I worked in the field of biological consulting for a few years. Again, didn't make me happy.
Yep.
I enjoyed the field work. But I hated the winters of writing those reports. And
yeah,
then finally made the transition.
It's funny, like the way you sort of talk about it, it's just a reflection of how so many, you know, arguably fantastic academics and fantastic minds feel, right? Because, you know, you're talking about this massive pile of shit, and a lot of it is brought on by academia itself and by sort of the system of education and the way it's built around funding and a few other things like that, that makes it sort of incredibly difficult. And I think a lot of people sort of get very, very stifled by it and sort of either lose the love or come to terms with the reality of the situation and sort of lose maybe a great mind out of the system that could have potentially have done something great. So did you feel that there was sort of a lot of maybe not issues, but when you mentioned it to sort of that pile of shit that you wanted to climb, why was it like that? Do you think it was the academia itself, or do you think that the world of biology was just something you weren't actually interested in?
No, I just didn't like the it didn't make me happy. Right, I wanted something that had a more of a physical component. I had something where... This is kind of a weird thing that correlates between both the fire... I'm a firefighter. I've been a firefighter for 20 years. And jiu-jitsu. This thinking about why I enjoy jiu-jitsu and martial arts so much actually helped me make the transition to firefighting. Personally, I really, really enjoy training to do something and then doing it for real. Whether that is a finish to the armbar when the guy links his hands together. Okay, I'm going to put my foot in here. Then I'm going to bait the roll. And then I'm going to do this. And then trying it out, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. Hopefully it works. That's incredibly satisfying to me. As well as training to do a new type of auto extrication where we pop the door panels in a certain way, or type of training to ventilate a house fire in a certain way, or mitigating, using a certain tool for a hazardous materials call, and then going and doing it. The training to do something and then actually doing it was really appealing to me. I actually considered going into the army for that same reason.
Okay.
Because that was the other kind of route where you train to do something and then you spend a bunch of time hoping that to get the opportunity to do it. I think jiu-jitsu helped me realize that I enjoyed doing that as opposed to just working within a system and trying to, like, it a university system or research system. I mean, it's very, very, there are a ton of rules, and there are a ton of rules there for a reason, some of which are legacy and the system trying to protect itself, and some of which are there to ensure that your research is actually well done.
Legitimate, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's just, so, I mean, I don't want to go back to Corona, but right now there are a ton of studies floating around. Studies.
Mm.
And if a poorly done study can give you worse than poor, it can give you like information that totally sends you down the wrong path. And I've done it myself on lots of little experiments and lots of little studies. Like, hey, did you randomly assign those things to the treatment group? Like, oh no, I didn't. And then somebody goes back and proves to me that by my initial bias, I totally skewed the whole rest of the experiment. So, a lot of those rules are there for a reason. And a bunch of, like, also, I mean, academia, you do have to play, you know, there's a game you need to play. You need to, you know, you need to suck up to the right people to get tenure. You need to do this. You need to do that. You need to be willing to move pretty much anywhere because everyone wants to work at, you know, at the nice places.
Yeah.
So I didn't think it was for me.
Right. Right. I mean, I think that's sort of, is a bit of a testament as well to the thing that sort of I've talked about a few times on this podcast with a few different people. It's sort of like the idea of doing sort of multiple things, like enjoying sort of multiple facets of life, for example, because the old idea of academia is like you do your thing. If you're a physicist, you do your thing. And almost like the idea of doing exercise is like kind of frowned upon because like why are you wasting your time doing that? The idea of sort of liking maybe a softer science like sociology or even like liking literature and things like that would be sort of frowned upon again purely because it's outside of your lane, and that is obviously changing now, but there's still sort of a lot of that going on, right? There's still a lot of that going on. So obviously throughout your time you've sort of spent a big portion doing martial arts as well as studying, you know, you're enjoying nature, you have other ideas going on. So how do you sort of feel about that sort of perspective?
I think if you want to be the best in the world at something, if you want to be a Roger Gracie, a Marcelo Garcia, an Albert Einstein, and everyone's immediately going to point to his playing the violin. I don't know how much playing the violin he was doing when he was developing the theory of general relativity.
Not a whole lot, in my guess.
A Stephen Hawking. If you want to be the very, very best at a field, you've got to spend a ton of time. Like it's not the 10,000 hour rule at that point, it's the 100,000 hour rule.
Yeah.
If you're content to be pretty good at something, it's a curve of diminishing returns, right? I'm pretty good at jiu-jitsu. I've been doing it a long time. I've got a pretty good body understanding. If I wanted to compete again, if my body would hold up to it, which it probably wouldn't, I would need to dedicate almost all of my time. I'd need to basically resign being a parent or farm that out somehow. And if I wasn't busy training, I would be busy doing rehab. I'd be busy sleeping 10 hours a day or maybe 12 hours a day, ice baths, and then watching tape, right? That's what I would need to do. So I think there are a lot of, I mean, the term is polymath, right? Somebody who's great at many things. I think there are some obvious exceptions if you look into the history of science or the history of anything of people who did manage to achieve very high levels at different things. I think that's kind of a rarity, which is kind of why we look at it and marvel.
Yeah, admire
most of the time when you've got somebody who's really, really good at something, they're almost Asperger-y about it. It's almost like they have low-grade autism and they're like spending every moment sitting in the corner, rocking back and forth. Now I'm alienating your Asperger's audience. Sitting, rocking back and forth, thinking about whatever it is.
Yeah.
I used to work as a care aide in a home for autistic adults. And there was a girl who wasn't super high functioning, but she was moderately high functioning, who was obsessed with the B-side of a Bee Gees album. Wow. One particular Bee Gees album. I don't know which one. I can't remember. And that was her obsession. Now imagine somebody who's super high functioning and has that level of focus and intensity on, I don't know, heel hooks. Right? I mean, somebody like Eddie Cummings back in the day, who would be up till 4 a.m. working on new transitions on his at-home grappling dummy after having spent all day watching tape and gone to 6 classes or something like that. It's hard on the... And jiu-jitsu is a little bit harder because it's hard on the body.
Yes.
I'll grant you that.
You're limited.
Yes. But in things like science, you really could spend all day researching and thinking about something. And maybe that's what you need to... If you're... Whoever solves quantum gravity reconciles quantum mechanics with Einstein's theory of gravity, they're going to spend a lot of time thinking about that. They're unlikely to do it on the weekend in between, you know, working on their juggling skills, their violin skills, and their side career as an actor in Hollywood. That's quite unlikely.
That's right. I mean, Newton sort of famously, you know, those stories of him waking up in the morning, sort of kicking his feet over the side of the bed to get up, and then a thought coming to him and him sitting on the side of the bed for 12 hours of the day thinking of this one thought, and he hasn't got up to eat breakfast or wash or anything like that, just because, like you said, he's so obsessed by the idea.
And then he had that miracle year in which he invented, what was it,
calculus?
Yeah, calculus and Newtonian mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then spent the rest of his life dabbling in alchemy.
Alchemy. Yeah.
Right. Going completely down a rabbit hole that essentially added nothing to the body of human knowledge. But maybe it could have, right? How was he to know?
Yeah, how does he even know? Exactly. One thing I want to talk about, I listened to sort of, this was a little while ago now, maybe a good month or two ago. It was actually about the canoe trip that you took recently. And it was on the Adventure Life podcast, I think it was called, something like that. One thing you had mentioned in that, which sort of made me laugh again, because it reflects some of my own experiences as well as some of the sort of other people who are doing their PhDs or whatever, is you, for the longest time, was sort of obsessed with physics, and you thought you were going to be a physicist, and then that suddenly changed. So it's interesting for you because you've sort of changed tracks pretty dramatically in two occasions, right? So you've wanted to do physics, and you've sort of changed tracks to biology, which is kind of as far from the end of the scientific spectrum as you really get. And then the next step, you've gone from biology to sort of outside of science into firefighting and jiu-jitsu. So this sort of path of changing tracks, do you think, what is the importance of that? How do you think people do that? Because, you know, I've had many moments where I'm like, should I change my mind? It's how much of it should be like bulldoggedness and how much of it should be...
That's the great mystery, trying to find the way to thread the needle between being too dumb to quit and just, are you maybe not pushing through enough? That's a really, really tough question. If I had one, I mean, sometimes it's obvious, right? Like somebody wants to be an entrepreneur, say, but they don't actually like writing blog posts.
Yeah.
They don't actually like writing emails. They don't like the math and they don't like the work. Like, okay, that person you can reliably advise that, like, dude, this probably isn't for you, because if you're going to make a business work, realistically, you're going to bleed through the eyeballs. So once in a while, you can advise people, but in general, like the idea of parsing when to quit and when to move on, that's really tough, and it was agonizing for me. I mean, it took me a year or a year and a half of agonizing about leaving physics, and it was really a shock when I got to university. I didn't realize I didn't like it. I didn't like the career path that this laid out. I didn't want to spend my whole life in front of a computer. And it was really by chance that I found the next thing. It was a chance conversation. So I think one guiding principle could be, does it make you, is it, because there's a trouble. There's things that you might be good at, but that don't make you happy.
Yes.
And that's the trap. Or things that you're good at, things that make you money, but don't make you happy. And just because you're good at something doesn't mean you should do it necessarily.
That's weird.
You really got to find the intersection between things you're good at and things you like bring you pleasure or things that you enjoy doing, and find where those two things cross over. Mm. Because at that junction, it often doesn't feel like work. I mean, there's that old saw about find what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And I'm here to tell you from the future that that's not entirely true. I have bled through my eyeballs to build up grapple arts and all that. And there have been many, many cursing sessions. So it might not be that you enjoy the process, but you find the process satisfying. So I think this idea of finding something that you find satisfying, satisfaction and pleasure are different. And satisfaction is longer lasting. Mm. And so finding something that's satisfying and finding something that you're good at, if you can find that junction, I think there's the rub. And how do you find that? I mean, it's like the idea of a minimum viable product, right? Like,
yeah,
I know Google Glass didn't pan out, right? Remember those stupid ass glasses that people were wearing?
Idea was great, but
did you have a set?
No.
I neither did I, and if I did, I wouldn't admit it.
Yeah.
But the minimum viable product that they did at Google was like a sheet of acetate and a projector, right? They didn't spend 10 years building it. They mocked it up quickly, and they said, this is kind of sort of what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
Similarly, when I started thinking about firefighting, which really came out of a random conversation about this idea of training and then doing something and what professions come out of that, it was a chance comment. And then I started really investigating it as much as possible, talking to every firefighter I knew. It turns out I knew a ton of firefighters who were doing jiu-jitsu. There was a community that had an early adoption of that, for sure.
Natural intersection, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a kind of a jockey, physical, yet cerebral thing. And so trying to find out more about that without committing fully to the process of signing on, and then trying to gather information. So I think if you can find some way to get an experience, say you wanted to become a cop. I don't know. I wouldn't want to be a cop, but say you wanted to become a cop. Is there a way you can do some ride-alongs? Is there a way you can go and interview as many different cops as you can? Is there an information night? Look up what the salaries are. Look up, try to experience that thing from as many different things as you can, but quickly. Just get little tastes, and then you'll be making your decisions with much more information. Similarly, I mean, jiu-jitsu, if you don't know what club, if you move to a new city or you want to start, and you don't know where you should start, is a super common question. The answer is easy. Make a list of all the clubs within your radius that you're willing to travel to and go visit all of them. Every single one, go train there, take an intro class, whatever their process is, ask them about the money, make notes because you're going to forget it all. And then at the end of it, it'll be pretty obvious. Like, man, I really liked these two places. And these places were full of douchebags. And as opposed to wondering about it endlessly, go experience it. It's not a big commitment to just go try a class. You're about to do something that might take 10 years of your life.
Yeah.
It's worth 5 nights of your life to go experience it. Because one night of experience is worth, 500 hours of doing research on the internet.
Funnily for me, because I actually studied physics and chemistry for undergraduate. I was set on physics as well, and it took me ages to sort of set up to get into this honors program. So many emails and talking to people, and I was about halfway through the first semester and was not enjoying it even remotely. And I remember I went up to one of the professors and I was asking for a small extension of 2 days because we had so many assignments, and this unhealthy, skinny, not nice professor basically said to me, like, if you want to do physics, you're going to have to, sacrifice your exercising, sacrifice jiu-jitsu. Because I think I had a competition or some seminar or something to go to that weekend. And as soon as she said that to me, the walk home, I quit. I quit the honors. And because it was like just one of those moments, if you're not enjoying it and people are telling you have to stop the things you do enjoy, there's some sort of issue there.
Was it? How many years ago was that?
Not too long ago now. That was about maybe 3 years ago.
And how many days have you lain there at night going, man, I made the wrong decision.
Oh, zero.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like zero. Leaving a bad relationship. Like,
yeah.
It there's sometimes when you're in a bad relationship and you walk away from it and, like, you don't look back a single day going, man, I wish I'd made a different decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a bit, I mean, it would be different. And you know what? If you all of a sudden were overcome with grief, like, man, I was just in a terrible spot there.
Mm.
I actually hate jujitsu. I love physics. You could go back.
Absolutely.
I mean, it would be difficult. There'd be hoops to jump through. You'd have to show contrition.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Whoops. But it would be doable.
No, you're right. You're right. We're getting to sort of the last 15 or so minutes of the podcast. I do want to spend a bit of time mentioning sort of one other thing, which is about the canoe trip that you've recently done. Because first of all, an incredible thing and something that I've always, not that specifically, but that sort of pursuit is something that's really, I suppose, always appealed to me. But just learning then, it sounds like you've actually done this trip, a similar trip, a couple of times before.
I've actually done three major solo trips. I did roughly a, I'll say, 1,000-kilometer trip when I was in my early 20s when I finished my undergrad. And as I said, I came back from that trip and found out that my brother had been killed. And so that, I wouldn't say my life went into a spiral, but like for the next year, really nothing happened. I worked shit jobs and just was processing that, really, and processing being at the end of studies. I didn't really have a direction, and I had a couple years that I could use that master's degree for. And so then, kind of to go process that, all that, I started planning a longer trip, which took me from the BC Alberta border down, sorry, up the Athabasca, across Lake Athabasca, up the Fond du Lac, over the Height of Land, up down the Cochrane, over the Height of Land, and down the Seal River to Hudson Bay, and then down to Churchill. So that was actually 2,800 kilometers. And that, I had it planned for 100 days, and that took 82. And so that was the second big trip. And then I got, you know, respectable. I had a business, I had a family, I had a job, and I also had a kidney transplant. I was dying of kidney failure, had a kidney transplant. And so kind of the last trip I did was kind of a celebration of having survived, right? Having survived a tough divorce. I'm on good terms with that person now, but it sure wasn't that way for years.
I'm sure.
I mean, to prove that I'm on good terms, you have to be on good terms with somebody to go, you know, honey, I know I divorced you. Would you mind taking the kids for, like, oh, I don't know, 6 to 8 weeks while I go up to the Arctic?
While I paddle.
Yeah, while I go. So she did, and I'm eternally grateful. And if anybody's going through a tough time with regards to that, like, I'll point to that as a case in point to do your very, very best to develop a good relationship with your ex, even if they're screwing you financially, even if you're suffering financially, like, you got kids together.
Make some bridge.
Yeah, you're going to have to be working together until those kids are 25 or maybe later if one of them ends up in jail, right? You're in for the long haul. And so because I had built those bridges, which was difficult. So that this last trip was, I hadn't done a long trip for, like, I want to say I'd been thinking about it for something like 25 years.
Right.
But I just had not been able to do it. And finally, you know, first I had a new job, the fire department, I couldn't really leave. Then, you know, kids, then a divorce, then a dying of kidney failure, then a kidney transplant. Like, there were a whole lot of really good reasons why I couldn't do that. But this idea of this, it's the route I took is a route that's been used for thousands of years by the Inuit coming south to trade, and by the Dene, or the Chippewan Indians, going north to hunt caribou. And depending on which group had died of smallpox more recently, that border between the Dene and the Inuit moved south and north. But it's very rarely traveled these days. I mean, maybe one group a year does it.
Oh, wow.
And so I also wanted to see if, you know, I could handle that in a 50-year-old body, and mm-hmm. I did. I mean, it was very painful.
I can imagine.
There's something about spending initially 8 hours a day paddling. I was just wrecked. I could barely sleep. Yeah, but by the end, I was up to 14 hours a day.
Oh, really? You sort of adjusted as time went on then?
Yeah, and then I just pushed myself harder.
Right.
I mean, it's a bit of a race against time as you're up there and the season is progressing.
Mm.
I mean, as you get later into August, especially in early September, the weather around Hudson Bay becomes very unstable.
Okay.
And the last 4 or 5 days, I knew that a really big storm system was moving in. It actually came a day early. So the last 5 days was basically
hammer and tongs.
Yeah, you know, sleep for maybe, like, I wouldn't say sleep, lie down on some clothing because my Thermarest had blown apart by that point. I didn't have any padding. So I had like little bits of foam that I had used to pad my my canoe out, and, you know, tore that off and like would kind of try and find a soft patch of tundra to like lay various bits of Ensilite foam down and kind of rest for 6 hours and maybe sleep for 4 or 5 maybe, and then get up and go. And I say the last 5 days were a really good push.
Mm-hmm.
And so did I enjoy it? No. Did I find it satisfying? Yes. Mm-hmm. There's a term in concept in mountaineering called the 3 stages of fun. Have you heard this? There's type one fun. So type one fun is when you're doing it and you're like, this is awesome. So glad I did it. So glad I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Type two fun is when it sucks when you're doing it, but then you're glad that you did it when it's over.
Right.
So think like a hard sparring session.
Yeah.
Where you can barely breathe and you're getting mashed and you fight your way out. And like no one part of it is fun. But afterward, you're like, man, that was a good battle.
Yeah.
Type three fun is where it takes a year or two to process and go, okay, I'm glad I did that. That was fun. But it sure wasn't fun in the moment or in the immediate aftermath. So I'll say it was bordering on type 2, 3 fun. Type 2.5.
That's sort of what I wanted to ask you as well. Like, it's always typical with any sort of extreme, I guess, athletic pursuit like that. Or even I've experienced it in sort of traveling. You can get it in careers and things like that as well. You have certain, I suppose, expectations and cliches of like an emotional roller coaster that you sort of think that you're going to have or other people think you're going to have. But I always feel like the moments that you feel those emotions are in different times than you thought you would. So for an example, like when you go, maybe you go to India and you want to go see the Taj Mahal, you know, you think that's going to be the most amazing moment of your life. And that might be the smallest moment of your trip. And the best thing could have been when you took a train and there was an Indian family in the carriage with you and that experience of having a conversation with them, for example. So how was it for you that the moments that you sort of felt fear, the moments that you sort of felt completely fed up, the moments that you felt pleasure or happiness of being there, how was the expectations versus what actually kind of came out of the wash?
I knew what I was trying to do in that timeline that I was doing, and also the amount of upriver work, because mm-hmm. there's a big difference between 100 kilometers going downriver when you're paddling and maybe portaging around the occasional bit of whitewater and slogging your way up that same river. Like that's, and I knew that there was a very, very significant upriver component.
Right.
And as it turns out, the water was quite high, which meant that that was even more work than I had thought.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew it would be tough. And I kind of, maybe to give myself a way out, I had given myself like a 60% chance of success. Mm-hmm. Right? There were various outs that I could have taken. I didn't know if my body would fall apart. I didn't know if my... I knew my brain could handle it. Because I been in isolation before. The first long trip I did, I didn't know. But by this point, I'm not too concerned about the isolation component. But that's a really big thing that most people talking to me about.
Sure.
This is what they don't know that they could handle. And I didn't know if I could handle it until the first time. And it was how I got up to that first time was baby steps, right? Like go out for an afternoon, go out for 3 days, go out for 4 days. All right, now it's time for, now it's time for 50 days or whatever. But there were certainly lots of moments of doubt. Like, can I actually do this? Mm. I remember on like the second or third day, my hand, the back of my hand
right.
swelled up so much or swole up that I couldn't see any of the ligaments or tendons. Mm-hmm. And it just looked like a marshmallow. I didn't bang it. I didn't strain it. I think it was just an overuse injury. But your mind starts doing these funny things. Hey, Stefan, like literally,
yeah.
your mind is looking for a way out. And it's this speaks to that whole idea of knowing when to quit.
Mm.
Your mind is going like, Stefan, that hand is swollen. It's probably an infection. Really, it's probably an infection. And if you don't get that taken care of, man, you could lose the hand. Man, you could probably lose your whole arm.
Mm.
And then you're going to have to live for your whole life without an arm. And it could kill you. And like your mind runs away there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It takes some, you know, rational thinking to like, okay, like let's dial this back. Mm. Let's not catastrophize here. I've got antibiotics. Maybe I should start taking some of them prophylactically and see if it mm-hmm. makes a difference. I can bail out here. I can bail out here. Here are my bailout options. Here are my plan Bs and plan Cs. And I'm not that far into the bush yet. You know, I can call a float plane if I have to. It'll be embarrassing. But that doubt creeps in repeatedly. That, you know, like doubt is a vicious little creature and it sits in its cave and it waits for a moment of weakness. And then when you're suffering for some legitimate reason, it pounds it like, haha, I've got it's you time. Now, you bastard.
Yeah.
It jumps out of its cave. And if you learn to recognize that, you can go, ah, there you are again. Like, there's doubt. But knowing how to separate doubt and fear from legitimate doubt and fear. Like, if you just disregarded all doubt and fear and just went, like, I'm worried about this rapid. Screw you. I'm going to run this rapid. Well, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Right?
Irresponsible. Like,
I'm worried about crossing this 20-kilometer stretch of water out in the open in the late afternoon when thunderstorms kick up. Screw you. I'm going to paddle across it. You're not the boss of me, fear. Mm. Well, guess what? The lake and the thunderstorm doesn't care that you're not afraid. You're dead. So threading that needle is a difficult one. It really comes with experience. Mm. It comes with erring on the side of caution. But at the same time, you also got to recognize when that your own inner voice is trying to talk you out of doing something just because you're hurt or you're tired or you're exhausted or you're scared. So that's a tough one.
And when you return back, when you finally finish it all, do you feel energized and do you feel like more equipped to sort of deal with the rigmarole of daily life and your business and things like that? Or do you feel that it's more difficult to deal with those things?
I think in general, it's made it better.
Right.
I've checked a great big thing off my life list.
Mm-hmm.
That's been on my life list for 20 years.
Big deal then.
Thinking about it for 25. And so it feels really good to have done that. It's not the last time I'm going to head north, but it's, you know, I'll give it a couple of years, or if I go north, I'll go with friends or I'll go with family and probably won't be going for 14 hours a day. Right.
Different we'll type
have
of time trip.
To have some campfires and, you know, roast some marshmallows and hang out a bit.
Go fishing maybe or something. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But in the short term, after I was destroyed, it probably took me 2 months to start feeling better.
Really?
I lost 15 pounds.
Wow.
Like I really, really pushed myself hard. And whether it was incipient rhabdo, or I don't think it was rhabdo. I didn't have the drop in kidney function. It's something I monitored pretty closely. But
I'm sure
whether it hormonal burnout or some endocrine thing, or like I beat the crap out of myself.
Mm.
And just being wet and cold and working as hard as you can for as long as you can, and really only stopping because if you don't stop right now, you're going to be trying to find a campsite in the pitch black.
Yeah.
In an area where there aren't that many campsites, that's a physically difficult thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't encourage people to go do that because it's unless they have a whole ton of experience in that, right? Build your experience slowly because it's really only that experience that tells you, how dangerous something is.
The right and wrong. Yep.
Yeah, it making little mistakes in safe and controlled environments helps you judge, helps you avoid making mistakes in big and uncontrolled environments. Right? I've done a ton of whitewater kayaking and whitewater canoeing, and I've flipped thousands of times.
Right, right.
And rolled up and carried on. It's pretty rare in on wilderness trips,
mm-hmm.
right? It's really a big deal if you do it in a wilderness trip. If you're play boating with friends in a rapid with an easy run out, hey, they'll laugh at you or you'll laugh at them, but no big deal.
Yep. Okay, Stefan. I think that's about the hour mark, and I don't want to steal too much more of your time. So you've sort of mentioned it a couple of times there, you know, some of the articles that you've written specifically about coronavirus and jiu-jitsu, and also just I assume you've got a lot of information out there more about your canoeing trip that you've taken. So if people are interested and they want to find more, what should they do?
Okay. One kind of hub is grapplearts.com/articles. That's where I've gotten the most recent stuff that I've got published. You can also access that if you search either iTunes or the Play Store for BJJ Master app. Because within that app, I've got links to both my articles
right.
and to my podcast and to most of my instructionals, soon to be all of my instructionals. So that's kind of a one central hub. If you like your stuff on your phone, that's a good way. If you want my opinions on coronavirus, and this is a couple of weeks old, my mm-hmm. opinions haven't really changed that much.
Mm-hmm.
If you search for COVID-19 and BJJ, you'll probably find the article I wrote on that I disseminated. Right. And this is back in the day when I was recommending that clubs take a 2-week hiatus from right. training until we figure this out. I think at this point it's more than 2 weeks. It
for sure.
needs to be for more than 2 weeks. And I think even if the various economies of the world open up again, which is a lot of pressure to do, I think they'll be staged. For the most part, there'll be gradual staged reopenings. And I don't think jiu-jitsu clubs will be in the first or second stage.
No.
I don't see it. I wish it were different. I mean, this is an art that I've spent 25, 30 years promoting, and I've got a heavy financial investment in.
Mm.
But I wish it were different. If people want that more information about that solo trip, I'm just in the process of editing some of the videos.
Oh, no way. Shot.
Yeah, I put a short little video.
Yeah, I saw that one, yeah.
Yeah, it's like 3-4 minutes long. I've probably got about 60 or 70 minutes of footage
mm-hmm.
total that I'm trying to edit together into something coherent. There's also a blog article,
mm-hmm.
which you can get to if you go to grapplearts.com/solo. So my one indulgence on that trip, I brought a couple books on a Kindle,
okay,
which are on my phone, but I didn't bring a fishing rod. I didn't bring many books.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really listen to a whole lot of music, and that was mostly because the difficulties of charging my electronic devices when it's overcast and raining are really quite considerable.
And the weight as well, I imagine, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's all, every bit of weight adds up. The one indulgence, and it was a little bit of a safety mechanism, was I did bring a small satellite dish,
mm-hmm.
and I did upload photos every day.
Oh, okay.
Close to every day. I mean, it was funny. There was like one satellite in the sky, just, you know, 2 fingers width above the horizon. And if you were camped in a place where there were no trees and no hills, you could transmit. And I think it was something like $3,000 a gigabyte. Like, it was crazy. It's like people complain about their cell phone rates. No, I got you beat on that one. So I'd be uploading these heavily compressed JPEGs.
Right.
And a little bit of text to accompany each one of them. So those ended up on my Instagram.
Okay.
And then I took all those and put them onto grapplearts.com/solo. I am working on a book on that.
Okay.
Trying to not just make it like, hey, and then I did this other cool thing, and then I did this other cool thing. Trying to draw some of the larger lessons out of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming along really slowly. People talk about how hard it is to write a book.
It's a hard hustle, I can imagine.
Yeah, that's... And you're trying not to come across as a superhero douchebag.
Yeah.
And you're trying to remember back and trying to figure out how to put people in that moment. It'll get done. Still working on it.
But with time.
So grapplearts.com/solo. You can see some of the pictures and some of the reports from the field. And some of, keep in mind, this was typed with freezing fingers wrapped in a sleeping bag at night. So there are typos in there, but that's what the people who were following me on Instagram got at the time. And so that's what you're going to get.
Perfect, perfect. Sounds good, Stefan. Well, thank you very much for taking your time out and speaking to me and telling us a little bit about what you do and the canoe trip and everything else.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and good luck there in Korea.
If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please subscribe to us. Go to any of our social media accounts or website. Tell your friends, tell your grandparents. Do anything you can do in your power to help us out, because it will allow us to continue doing this podcast for everybody, which we greatly appreciate. Thank you for the support, and see you next time.